And transition over to our presentation content. But before I do that, I have two quick polls that we're going to launch on the screen because we'd like to learn a little bit about those of you who have connected in our session today. Now, there should be a new pop-up poll window simply asking where you're joining us from so you can pick an option. If you happen to have a group of people, hopefully you're all from the same place because you're sitting together in one location. But again, try to find one that best fits. And as I'm seeing these responses come in, I'm going to give it just another moment or two and then we'll slow down those responses. And I'm going to go ahead and close this one out and quickly share those results. And just so that everybody joining us virtually in today's webinar can see, it looks like we have a pretty large group coming from the Northeast US as well as the Central US, but we do have a pretty big representation from Southeast US and then other parts of the country. And then there are a number of international participants today. So that's great. We're glad to have you here. We do have one other question we'd like to ask you all to learn a bit about you, and that is what best describes your profession. So you'll now see a new poll on the screen and you'll have a series of options. You can pick one, but not more than one. And again, if you have multiple people, you'll have to fight it out amongst yourselves to pick one representation and then send that vote on in for your location. And as I'm starting to see these responses come in, Abe, again, I'll just quickly remind you, you can go ahead and start sharing the presentation content. Amy, I'll ask you to come on camera to get ready to take over the facilitation duties. And I see those responses are starting to slow down. So I'm going to go ahead and end that and share the results. And let's take a look at who's joining us virtually. So it does appear as though we have a very large sector coming in from state, local, or tribal governments. And then the other big groups are economic development professionals and environmental consultants. But we do have a number of guests who are identifying as other. So that's a great mix of people joining us. All right, well, with that, let me stop sharing those results, close out the polls. Abe, I can confirm we can see those slides. Amy, let me spotlight you for the audience, and I'll turn it over to you to get things started today.
Jean, thank you so much. It's always great to have you walk us through all the different parts of Zoom, make sure everyone can participate fully, keeping us on track. So hello, everybody. I'm so glad that you're here for our second webinar in this series for EPA's Redevelopment Academy. For those of you who joined us last month, welcome back. For those of you who are new, welcome. I'm really excited about the information that we're going to talk about today. As part of EPA's Redevelopment Academy, one of the things that we're really trying to do is to help communities across the nation just become more familiar with the redevelopment process for contaminated or potentially contaminated sites. And risk in all its different forms is a huge part of that. And so we're really going to talk through today what those different risk factors are, what you can do to mitigate or minimize your risk. And then one of the great things we're going to talk about is, you know, how do you pull all the information together that you might have about your site into what we're calling an investment package. So Abe, can you flip to the next slide? Just want to show everybody that these are the main things that we're going to cover today. Once again, we have our team of experts from Vida Nuova. They are a national consultancy that really specializes in helping communities reposition sites for investment. And in addition to private practice, they've worked with us at EPA over the years, providing technical assistance to communities, large and small, to help them get their brownfield sites cleaned up and reduced. So really looking forward to today, looking forward to your questions. We have three question breaks, so send them in. And I'm gonna turn things over to Vida Nuova. Michael.
Great, hi everyone. Please move to the next slide, Ed. So we have a packed agenda. So we're going to move very quickly through the introductions. I do want to just make a little commercial for the third webinar. We have currently three developers who will open their books, a housing, an industrial, and a solar opportunity that brings the benefits back to the community. So I'm very excited about the next webinar, which is kind of building on what you'll be learning today. That's November 19th. So with that, I wanna introduce Jim, Pat, and Will. Pat, you met last time, a public finance and real estate expert from the Fort Collins area. Jim, longtime Vitanova person, has worked on a number of guidance or guides for EPA, and he'll be introducing one to you today that we've been working with EPA on for the last couple of years. And Jim knows a lot about transferring risk from his private sector background, having transferred over 3,000 sites when he worked for British Petroleum. And then we also do that as part of Vitanova. And then finally, Will, and we want to make sure we have enough time to give Will time, but we're going to talk about another guide that's EPA's putting out very shortly called Attracting Investment, which he was the primary author on. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jim, and we do look forward to your thoughts and questions. And just so you know, all of these are being recorded. Webinar one is on the website, and this one will be shortly after in case your buddies miss it. Okay, Jim.
Ready?
Next slide, Abe.
You can go one more. Okay, well, today we are going to talk about dealing with and removing barriers, but we're going to set this up a little bit with a hypothetical property to get started with. And while this property is hypothetical, it pulls its examples from actual sites that we have worked on over the years. And it is somewhat simplified for purposes of this discussion, but I think it'll give you a pretty good idea of some of the issues that are encountered and how to move forward in addressing those. Next slide. So our hypothetical site is, or our process that we're going to be talking about today deals with repositioning sites. And I'm going to pass this on actually to Patrick, and he's going to walk you through this first portion.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Appreciate that. I'll say good morning, everyone, as I'm located in Colorado. So yeah, just to start things off, we wanted to give a brief background of the first webinar for context, background, and continuity purposes. So starting here, if you were able to attend the first webinar, this slide should look familiar. This is really a visualization of the framework that we use when we're working with communities to reposition properties. The first webinar was focused on that area that's faintly outlined in blue. So that's the understanding needs and collecting information. So really, we like to begin this process with understanding a community's needs, their goals, what sites they have to work with, whether they've engaged with the community or if already on the opportunities, or if that's something that still needs to occur. The other piece that we really focused on as part of that first webinar was the value of collecting information, just really getting to know your site. And that's certainly true from the environmental side, but also, you know, land use options, site constraints, infrastructure needs, what the market can support, et cetera. Next slide, please, Abe. So quick plug on on a guide here. So this is the Revitalization Ready Guide. We mentioned this a number of times in the first webinar, and we'll continue to reference it through these next two webinars. This guide is soon to be published, and this is really a comprehensive guide that lays out a process for land revitalization, covers, you know, all of the things that we've covered in webinar one, and again, the content that we'll be addressing today as well. I think I'd also like to highlight the fact that there's a number of really what we think are some very, very valuable worksheets that are contained as an addendum to the guide. These worksheets help you compile and organize information on the site. And additionally, there you'll also find a pro forma, which we'll be speaking about later today. Next slide, please. In our last webinar, we mentioned the great value of really understanding your site. And, you know, this is certainly what the due diligence process is really about. Many on the call participating today may be familiar with due diligence as it relates to environmental and just the importance of doing that in terms of conducting your all appropriate inquiry and getting yourself the circle of liability protections. But it's equally important to really understand your site from a real estate standpoint. And that's, you know, not only in terms of what the infrastructure needs and attributes of that property are, but also in terms of, you know, what the access looks like. You know, are there easements that are crisscrossing the site that are going to impact the development potential? What's the zoning? Is the zoning consistent with those community goals that we referenced earlier, and what, you know, what ultimately the property may be capable of and what the community wants to see there, and, you know, other characteristics and attributes of the site that that may be relevant to the reuse of the property. Next slide. So the site reuse assessment is this is really a more formalized approach to conducting that, you know, the investigation of the property and coming up with the, you know, all the pertinent information relating to the site characteristics, again, what infrastructure needs might be necessary, you know, what offsite obligations that property might have in terms of transportation improvements, what the environmental conditions are, et cetera. And as I mentioned, this is a more formal process. There's an, actually a one pager that describes this in a little bit more detail. It's available on the EPA website. And this is one of the planning activities that can be conducted under your brownfield assessment grants. So it's something that, that really serves as the foundation for all of the steps, all of the succeeding steps that you might take to reposition a property. So it's a really important foundational start. Next slide, please. So really the conclusion from that site reuse assessment is the opportunities and constraints analysis. If you're following, again, that kind of more formalized site reuse assessment approach, it will sort those opportunities and constraints into these four thematic areas. So site characteristics and opportunities and constraints related to those site characteristics, opportunities and constraints related to the environmental side of things, land use and infrastructure. So it's really, it's gathering and investigating the property in all those different categories and really looking at that information through the lens of opportunities and constraints in these four categories. And with that, I'll hand it over to Jim and he can get into the really the new material, kind of the focus of today's webinar. So thanks.
Great, thanks, Patrick. Next slide, please. Yeah, as I mentioned, you know, we are going to be using a hypothetical site. And what Patrick just covered is sort of the data collection side of things of this process. And so what I want to do is just give you a little brief background on the site, some information about it, and then we'll talk about the site as we go through the process. Next slide. So we're dealing with typically a small community around 10,000 folks or so, you know, generally rural. And in this particular case, there was a manufacturing facility that was located on about 10 acres in this town for a pretty good time, probably close to 100 years, starting in the early 1900s or so. The site operated in various types of manufacturing operations until about 2000 when it was shut down permanently. And since then, the site has fallen into a state of disrepair, broken windows, those kind of things on buildings. And ultimately, the town decided to acquire the property in order to get something moving on this particular property. The property itself is located primarily within a residential area. It's in close proximity to a downtown area and also close proximity to a local recreation area not too far from here. And while the buildings are in a state of disrepair, they're typically structurally sound. Buildings themselves, in particular the manufacturing buildings and the office buildings, are listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Next slide. During the first webinar, and as Pat has just gone over, we discussed things like evaluating community needs and concerns and completing the reuse assessment. So we've done that for this particular site, and based on these activities, we've identified some opportunities and constraints for the site. And as examples of the kind of opportunities, its location and proximity to a state highway, exit on an interstate, the buildings themselves are considered a potential opportunity because they are structurally sound. They're in pretty decent shape, and other buildings on the site as well. The utilities on the site have some value in that there's relatively low rates on some of the utilities. There's natural gas, and there's also high-speed internet associated with the facility. In addition, the zoning is fairly flexible for this particular property, which really allows for some opportunity for a developer to have sort of a fit-to-purpose development. Next slide. On the other side of things, there are some constraints associated with the site. It's a brownfield site, so as we would expect, there are environmental issues. There's groundwater issues, PCE in this particular case, along with its various degradation properties, products, as well as some hydrocarbons. Because of that, there are potential soil gas issues on the eastern half of the site if you were going to build in that area. And there's metals associated with the surface soils and some subsurface soils that are above a typical unrestricted use for the site. As mentioned, the buildings are structurally sound, but as with older buildings, there are asbestos issues and the potential for lead-based paints, as well as portions of the site are within a 100-year flood zone. Next slide. So with that as a little bit of background, what we want to talk about is the reuse planning process. So we started with community needs and concerns. We moved on to the reuse assessment. And taking all of that information now, let's come up with a plan, a reuse plan for the site. Next slide. The reuse plan really is something that's designed to pull together all of that information. It's in a process that provides for what I'll call a meaningful community engagement to address potential community needs and concerns and build public support. As many of you know, in any brownfield site, public support is a significant and important part in moving a project forward. Next slide. So the reuse plan starts with mapping and visualization of the information. And I want to emphasize this because I know personally I am a very visual person. And I think a lot of people are today very visual. So it's very important to use mapping and visualization techniques to display the property, the environmental issues, the constraints that may be associated with that, and any other information that may be helpful in looking at reuse options, looking and hopefully convincing folks that appropriate options are various options are appropriate. Another part of the reuse planning process is defining developable area. Now, in the case of our particular property, the entire 10 plus acres is considered to be developable. But that's not always the case for a lot of these sites. In some cases, you're going to have easements that come across the property that will restrict the ability to put a building over the top of that. You may be able to do parking and landscaping, but not construction. You may have wetlands. On some industrial sites, you may have closed industrial landfills or impoundments that have restrictions from use and those kind of things. And so it's important in the visualization to identify those, but also to extract those from the area that's potentially available for development. So when you're talking to developers, you can show them what they can use and what they can't use on the property. Next slide. So with an understanding of the characteristics of the property, what you need to look at next is sort of what are your options or what is your vision for reuse on this property. And And this is when you can explore this. This is typically something that you'd like to see as a community or a stakeholder involvement process. A lot of times we think of visioning, and we do visioning processes, you know, at the front end of evaluating a site. But if you have all of this information up front, you can put some reality to the visioning process so that the vision reflects not only the community's priorities and concerns, but it's integrated with what you know about the physical, economic, and environmental realities associated with the site that could affect, you know, how well a development is implemented and its success. So it does take into account the community needs and concerns, the environmental condition analysis, the land use, the infrastructure, as well as the developable area that's out there. If you look on the right-hand side of this slide, if you look at, for purposes of our site, our property, we've laid out two scenarios that they look a lot alike. The first, for both scenarios, we're looking at a residential retail mixed use, and we'll come back to the marketing issue or the market issue in a little while. But there's two options here. The first is to reuse the existing buildings. And the second would be to get a more flexible design and development by tearing down all of the buildings and building new. When you look at the property, you know, there is an available labor and workforce there from a construction perspective. The utilities are reasonable. There's access to the recreation and downtown. Internet is an important component, even for residential. And the zoning is flexible enough to allow, hopefully, the mixed use that we're looking for. Next slide. So considering the reuse scenarios that we've developed during this visioning process, what we need to do is look at each one of these scenarios and decide what are the issues that may affect the ability to conduct this development. We call them risks and liabilities. And these are generally tied to the constraints that we've identified on the front end, and also the fact that these liabilities and risks are something that could be not only something that the community in this particular case, who owns the property, may have liability or risks associated with it, but as well as a buyer, that they may become either legally obligated or accountable to deal with that from a contractual perspective. We break these up into sort of three categories. The first is environmental liability. And for our property, we don't have a responsible party for this site. We know we have soil and groundwater impacts. We know we have asbestos in the buildings. And that liability is going to need to be addressed in any development. On the financial side, we have soil and groundwater remediation activities, potentially demolition of the building, the asbestos removal, any old foundation removal. And there is somewhat of a market risk in the sense that a developer is assuming the ability to lease out the building once things are constructed. So in many cases, the financial liability ties to the environmental liability and other liabilities that are out there. And last but not least is community issues. And these can relate to a variety of things. You know, one of the issues is with the buildings in disrepair, there are safety and health hazards that need to be addressed. There may be neighborhood opposition to industrial uses because there is a perceived need for residential uses. Next slide. So with an understanding of these risks and liabilities, what we need to do now is really look at what are our potential options. How do we deal with these risks and liabilities? And this is sort of a first cut at looking at how to address these liabilities. And sort of the first step in all of this is really trying to make sure that you understand and quantifying risks. And we did a reuse assessment. There's environmental site assessments that may or may not have been done on the properties. But what's missing? Do we know everything we need to know about this site in order to understand and make decisions about the risks and liabilities? Look at it from the standpoint of it's filling information gaps. And those gaps can hinder your ability to define and quantify risk and in themselves create a set of risks as well. The other part of this is really quantifying it. So if we really understand it, can we quantify it? Can we identify what is it that has to happen in order to address this risk? and make some estimates as to how to deal with that. And we're going to talk about that a little more, Patrick will, when he talks about the pro forma, where we want to try to put some dollars to these risks. So that once they are understood and we feel comfortable that we have at least options for managing and controlling these, then we can start looking at other issues associated with it. So in the case of our hypothetical site on the right-hand side of the slide, you know, from the environmental liability, is there an opportunity to integrate the remedy with development on the property? For instance, can parking areas and pavement be integrated with an approach to address surface soils on the site? Can it deal with soil gas to indoor air issues, you know, by not building in those areas and using those areas for pavement? What are the options for remediating groundwater, dealing with soil, and asbestos removal would be another liability to address. How do we deal with those financially? Well, there could be some liability transfer. Maybe a developer is willing to incorporate the remedial action and old foundation removal in their development plan. On the other hand, the town may want to consider retaining some liability, maybe conducting the remedial action on the property, doing building demolition, doing asbestos removal. And in many cases, there may be various federal state funding that will help support a community doing that, particularly in the case that they own this property. And then last but not least, demolition of the buildings would clearly address the safety and hazard risk, but also reuse and refurbishment of those buildings would as well as bringing in the residential and retail mixed use. Next slide. So let's stop here for questions. I know I've rambled very quickly through a lot of information. Do we have any questions?
Hi, Jim. I actually have been monitoring the Q&A box. I have not seen any questions come in. So I think that we should just keep going and then we can get people can, but please, everyone, please do add your questions in so we have them ready to go. And we'll pause in a bit for another question break.
That's great. You're making it easy for me. Moving right along. Next slide, please. So what I'm going to do is pass this on to Patrick, and he's going to talk about this issue of market viability and also project economics.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Appreciate that. And let's go to that next slide, Abe. So yeah, market viability and project economics are of course critical if your goal is to attract private investment from a developer or investor. And, you know, we really think that understanding that, you know, even at a general and high level is really valuable and crucial, as it helps you to understand what it takes for a project to be viable. And how you do that is through a financial pro forma. And a pro forma is really just it's a fancy way of describing a financial analysis that you'll use to project financial returns for a project return. For a particular project, excuse me. And we'll go through that in just a bit here. A pro forma is really used to evaluate those returns and over different scenarios. And there are a number of different return metrics that are that can be used. Some of them fairly common, I would say, kind of in the industry and across the country. But different groups will have different ways of looking at it and will have different return goals and objectives. So some of this is also understanding your local market and what they're looking for. Financial models can really range from the fairly simple, which I think is generally what we're going to cover today, to the very complicated. In my opinion, I think the appropriate level for this very early stage is to start with something that's simple and just really try to understand those relationships and understand the numbers at an order of magnitude level. So next slide, please. Market viability. This slide could also be titled market conditions. So for this hypothetical scenario that Jim described and that we're going to use for these next slides, we have described this market as being a slow growth market, but there is residential demand. Whether that demand will support new construction is another question, and a question that you can begin to evaluate by doing some of the financial analysis that we'll describe. The potential viable land use options that Jim described would be mixed use, so residential and retail. The real driver of the finances, though, is from the residential side, so that retail side might actually be a detractor from the financials. Building demand and vacancy. So we have, in this hypothetical scenario, we've identified that there is a local demand for residential senior housing. Lease rates and rents, and this is not uncommon in smaller markets, but we, in this hypothetical scenario, there's not local comparable data. So you may need to look to another market, and that can be, you know, hopefully you'll find a very comparable regional market. That's probably the best comparison. But if you don't find that regional market, you may have to widen your search. But again, the goal would be to find a like-for-like market so that those rents are comparable. Same thing is true on the building cost standpoint. So didn't find any recent projects where you could find comparable building costs. That's not to say that you couldn't get a reasonable estimate from a local contractor, but you might also look to your regional data here again. So pulling from regional contractors or regional, or recently built regional projects that would be comparable to what you're trying to financially model. I won't go through the numbers, but to the right side are some of the construction costs for refurbishment and new construction that have been plugged into the model, and then also lease rates, so residential on a monthly basis, and then some assumption in terms of the size of the commercial retail office and warehouse uses there, obviously, but lease rates for those as well. So next slide, please, Abe. So I should say the financial model that we're using, a version of that is included in the guide that I was referencing earlier. So this is something that you'd have access to kind of through that guide. But the pro forma really begins by populating the Excel template with a number of basic information about the property and the development program. So that size and what are the existing buildings, and really that's more for informational purposes more than anything. And then in terms of the development program, that's really that next section. And so this particular model is referencing 75 what they're describing as high density residential units for a total square footage of 90,000 square feet of residential, 10,000 square feet of retail, which it says is one unit here. You know, that could be multiple units. Office and business incubator, 30,000 square feet. Again, maybe that's split up among a couple different users. And then a 65,000 square foot warehouse. So next slide, please. So in any pro forma, at least in any pro forma that's dealing with an operating business, you're going to have operating returns. And so, of course, those are populated on, with revenues. And in this particular case, again, we've got it's a mixed use scenario that includes residential, commercial retail, a bit of warehouse, and some office as well. So this is taking, looking at those rents on a per square foot basis and translating those into revenue on a per annum basis. And the residential annual operating expenses are assumed to be 30%. That presumably was taken from the local market. The commercial retail warehouse and office numbers there, we've not included expenses there, as those are, as you can see, they're triple net leases, which we don't need to get too far into the weeds on that, but essentially it means that the tenants are bearing the expenses for that space for property taxes, insurance, and common area charges. So the net number to the landlord is truly that in the case of commercial retail, that $13.50 per square foot. So that using the square footage numbers and the assumptions on space, and a fairly simple but hopefully more or less accurate expense ratio as well for the residential, we land on that total revenue figure that's cited here. And next slide, please. So in addition to the revenue side, of course, there's expenses. We mentioned the expenses on an operating basis that were covered really in that last slide, but there are also expenses or costs that relate to the development of the site. So this is going to include what we're throwing in here is under the land basis, which is purchase price, the asbestos abatement costs, whether there's demo involved for a current structure, and maybe shoring up structural support for any existing structure, and then the remediation number there, presumably environmental remediation. So your total all in for to get, you know, get yourself to have a site that you can do something with there. We're calling 3.9 million in this hypothetical scenario. The next section of the table here relates to the construction costs. So this is, you know, related to your development program. What are the costs to actually to build what you intend to do? And these are going to be both hard and soft costs. So the hard costs are included in here on a dollar per square foot basis. Again, this was derived from an area market. And sorry, just minimizing something. Area market and and then soft costs are assumed to be a percentage of the hard costs. Soft costs are those costs such as an architect, land planner, presumably in this case also the, you know, some of your city fees, those kind of things. So your total construction costs, including that contingency of 10%, is $47 million. And so total project cost before tax credits is that $51 million, which includes your land basis. So next slide, please. So the next couple slides are two different development scenarios. The first development scenario is looking at this project without incentives. And so we have derived the value of the project based on those operating returns and utilizing a cap rate. And I'll spare you kind of an explanation of a cap rate or going into too much detail on a cap rate, but you can think of this as an expected rate of return from that project, and it's very market-based. So in this particular market, for this type of project and the risks associated with that, you know, these property types, there's going to be a 7%, it should be a 7% cap rate. So that's what those projects trade in the market. So the market participants had said, if I'm going to buy this project, I want a project that has a return of 7%, and that's what they have been trading for. So using that 7%, you can back in the operating return, you can back into the project value. So that's where that $30,628,000 comes from. And so at that 7% cap rate, the value is a negative, the profit, excuse me, is a negative number. So that negative number is $20,589,000. So clearly this is not a project that can be successful without incentives. So next slide, please. It sounds like some good questions are coming in. And so, yeah, thanks for those and keep them coming. And we'll certainly tackle those in just a moment. So with the gap that we generally saw the magnitude of, we know that we need to work to address that gap if this particular development scenario is going to work. And so our resources for doing that are going to be, you know, local and state tax incentives for sure. Those tend to be the most robust programs that could be, you know, local tax incentives in the form of tax increment financing, or could be, you know, more of a federal program or federal and state program in the form of historic preservation tax credits, which I think is what's applied here. Additionally, there's other grants and sources of funding that can be an important part of the capital stack and can also be just a great assistance in the planning and front end part of the work here. So some of the risk and perhaps challenges of this project could perhaps be resolved by changing the development program or resolving some of the environmental issues. And again, that's where some of these grants and other sources of funding can be a big help. Next slide. So now we've got two additional development scenarios. One is is showing the site as a redevelopment scenario that has been refurbished. So those existing structures were retained, and we've used the historic preservation tax credits and a tax abatement credit in order to realize this project. And so if you see both of those are loaded under the tax credit portion here, that upper portion, and they're substantial. So $11.5 million in the case of the historic preservation tax credits and 11.3 in the case of that tax abatement credit, which presumably could be a local credit. So when we do that same analysis that was done previously without the tax credits, we see that now we do have a positive number under the profit, which of course is certainly moving us in the right direction. So now we have a positive profit margin there of $2.23 million if you undertook this project on a relative basis. So looking at profit as a portion of those total costs, that's a 4.36 profit margin. The project financial gap analysis that was used to indicate, well, what would it take for us to realize a profit percentage of 15% of total project costs? And in that scenario, we need an additional subsidy of $2.7 million. So that's just kind of backing into what's the magnitude of the gap there if what we're really trying to achieve is not that 4.36 margin, but a 15% margin. For that to be true, we would need an additional $2,750,000. So I'll try to keep moving through this. I know sometimes just talking about numbers, eyes can glaze over. But we think it certainly is important to understand the financial economics at a high level. And so next slide, please. So the second scenario that we're looking at here has stripped out the historic preservation tax credit. So this is a new construction scenario. So this is a scenario that Jim described where it's a bit more flexible because you're not confined by the buildings that you currently have. And so let's take a look at that. So you have additional flexibility, but you've also stripped out those tax credits, which were substantial. And so when we do that, we're looking at a negative profit here again. And so really pointing to the value of those historic preservation tax credits. And in this particular instance, the value of those buildings from a financial perspective as well. So if we look to conducting the same financial gap analysis as was done in the prior slide, we're showing that the full financial gap that's needed here in order to realize that 15% profit as a percentage of total project cost margin is $23.5 million. Next slide, please. So some key takeaways on the financial modeling. So for purposes of evaluating feasibility, again, we would say keep this high level. Don't get stuck in the weeds. We think it's most important to understand these relationships generally, most important to conduct some order of magnitude analysis, find out if this is profitable or not. Again, there are different investment groups and developers will have different ways of approaching this for themselves. And when they conduct a more detailed analysis, they're going to come up with different numbers anyways, and they may have different return expectations. So again, don't get too caught up in hitting a particular return benchmark, I think it's more important to model this generally and to derive some of the value that you get from actually understanding the economics of a project, which is really the second point. So use the proforma to understand the different challenges and their magnitude. So when you take the time, and again, we've done a very abbreviated process here, but when you take the time to populate the Excel spreadsheets and go through it, you know, the real challenges of the project, if they're not already known, will begin to express themselves. You'll understand, oh, is it the environmental challenges that are really holding us back here? Is it the offsite requirements of development? Is it the high construction costs? Is it a combination of everything? Is it the market? And so understanding, you know, where your challenges lies can be really helpful in directing your next steps. You know, maybe it's looking at a different construction approach or technique that can help resolve some of those challenges. Perhaps it's a different development program. You know, maybe, you know, if it's the retail side of a project that's really dragging it down, but the residential has a much smaller gap and maybe has more financial resources, then maybe you end up looking at an exclusively residential project. So the proforma, we think, can really shed a lot of light on the project economics and the failings or you know, those strengths. So financial, and then this third bullet point here is that financial incentives can be significant. So we saw there in the hypothetical scenario that we showcased here, they were incredibly significant. So the, you know, $22 million in financial incentives between the historic preservation tax credits and those local tax abatement. So don't underestimate the value and don't get discouraged when you see a big financial gap, because there can be resources to address those challenges. I'm not trying to suggest that it's easy, and many of these capital stacks get incredibly complicated when you look at really challenging projects, but you know, don't be discouraged, because there are tools and resources that can help. De-risking a project and or providing a project roadmap can also add significant value. So returns and, you know, risk and returns go hand in hand. And the, you know, the more risk you can pull out of a project, you know, the more developers and investors that will have an interest in looking at that project, because that, you know, they may have a risk profile that's fairly low, and they may not want to take on the environmental challenges, but they might be a really great operator or a really great developer, and you don't want to miss that opportunity in working with that group. Simply because the project maybe had some risks that you as a community member, you know, or you as a community could work to reduce. And then second part of this final bullet point is providing a roadmap for a project can really add significant value. There are different groups, different developers tackle different projects. And so when you have, you know, a piece of dirt there that it's really unknown what could happen there, maybe unknown what the community wants, unknown what the community supports, that's not a green light for a developer to really, you know, to take some time and really look at a project. So provide a roadmap for, you know, let a developer and let the development investment community know what it is that you're looking for, and give them as much ammunition and information on how to get there. So that's really that final point there. Next slide. Feasibility. Finally, we wanted to say, you know, there's many things that, you know, may not get cooked into the financial analysis, particularly when you're doing the financial analysis in the way that we did it, which is, you know, really high level. And so it's also very important to understand kind of what are those other key assets and opportunities for that particular site, for that particular project, and make sure that you lean into those and understand those. You know, and we've provided some examples here. You know, perhaps there are already local tax incentives that are ready to go. Maybe they weren't the ones that you modeled, but be aware of those and understand those assets. Perhaps the historic buildings that are there, they may look visually, really terrible, broken windows, et cetera, but perhaps structurally they're sound. And so, identify that and understand kind of the implications of those site conditions. Next point, I think we've covered this already, but again, the presence of constraints, risks, or liabilities isn't necessarily a reason to eliminate a reuse scenario. So with some of these bigger challenges also come resources to deal with those challenges. So if there are, higher and greater environmental challenges, often that can be coupled with higher and greater public financing and incentives to tackle those challenges. So simply because they exist, don't let that discourage you from evaluating that reuse scenario. Final point on this slide is mitigating the constraints, risks, and liabilities that make the implementation of reuse scenario impossible. And Jim mentioned this already, so I think we'll just kind of maybe leave it at that. But environmental liabilities, the city, the town may want to address some of those challenges. Could be abating the asbestos, could be capping the environment, some of the environmental issues, or perhaps it's even just better characterizing and understanding the problem so that you incent that third party to take a look at it, because they know the data is there and they feel like they can wrap their hands around the risk side of it. So, and next slide. And with that, we'll take some questions, and I minimize those. So let me do a little catching up here.
Sure, thanks, Patrick. We did have several questions come in. A handful are clarifying ones, which I'll ask first. And then there's a couple specific to the Performa that folks wanted to try to understand better. So if we've got time, we'll do as many as we can. So the first question that came in, a couple of people were wondering just about refurbishing buildings versus new construction. Does one approach tend to be more expensive than the other?
Yeah, that's a really great question and really hard to give a general answer to, but I would say a couple things. So if the historic building is, again, if it's structurally in really good condition, I think that this can certainly be the case. So that would not be surprising if rehabbing a historic building is less than new construction. It's also going to relate to size. So clearly, a much larger building on a new construction basis could be more costly. And if you have, if you've already got that footprint of that existing building and again, structurally it's intact, it could be much less. So, and importantly and important to the example that we discussed earlier, you also have the great aid of historic preservation tax credits. So.
Okay, next question. Can you clarify again the cap rate, what that is?
Sure. Yep. We were hoping to avoid talking about cap rate because I think this is a really good question. And this is, so a cap rate, again, I think in the most simplistic terms, cap rate is you can think of it as a rate of return for a particular project type. So for example, a residential multifamily cap rate in a large market might be 4%. And that really relates to the fact that there is really inexpensive capital. So institutional money that has, cheap capital that institutions have access to. And those tend to be fairly low risk projects. And so commensurate with that, you have a very low cap rate. So again, 4% is not uncommon for very large markets. For those who are more mathematically oriented, the capitalization rate is really, so it's net operating income divided by purchase price. So it's that relationship of operating income to the price of the asset, which is why it's so valuable in real estate as kind of a quick and dirty metric to determine your purchase price, because the cap rate will be fairly consistent for that asset type, and certainly in active markets for similar assets. So,
and Pat, if I could add, for brownfield sites, it's a ratio of risk, right? So you were talking about de-risking a project. If there's unknown environmental, if there's a lot of abatement to do, that cap rate will go up 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So that's the cost of money to be able to invest in a project like that. And as you de-risk a project, that cap rate will come down and the project becomes more valuable. So brownfield developers, you know, it's about their access to capital and how expensive that capital will be. Just another use of the cap rate in the brownfield world.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And, you know, that'd be on the other side of the spectrum from multifamily. So if a multifamily investment is in a fairly significant market, is considered fairly safe and has a, you know, let's say 4% return, as Mike just mentioned, you know, a brownfield investment in a much smaller market might need to carry a much larger rate of return. And it really, we're talking about this kind of risk versus rate of, you know, risk versus return relationship.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks, Michael. Another quick question, perhaps, is what do developers generally expect their profit percentage to be? Like, is there a percent of total project costs that they're generally expect to receive?
So, and I think this is a really interesting area, because I think you're going to get different responses again from different folks on this. And so the return metrics that I'm most used to, and I think are most common, are internal rate of return. And we'll try not to make this just a finance oriented conversation, but maybe that could be a topic for another day. But internal rate of return, equity multiple, and cash on cash return are more common, kind of in terms of, at least in my market, those are kind of what are most commonly discussed. But in general terms, you're looking at a return kind of in the, mid to lower teens, I would say, for just a generic typical project. And those are going to be, to Mike's kind of point earlier, if you're in a higher risk market, your return expectations might be higher, but you might also deal with a local investor who has a better understanding of that market and doesn't perceive as much risk in that market. And that group may take a lower rate of return because it's a market they're more familiar with. They might also, get the benefits of investing locally, and which might appeal to them, and so for those reasons might be willing to take a lower rate of return.
Yeah, now if I could add real quick, so there's a lot of institutional money, so there's huge buckets of institutional money sitting around, and if the cash flow returns are very, very low risk, like they are with logistics centers right now, you know, Amazon, those kind of things, they'll take extremely low returns on their investment. And that's part of what drives that cap rate down. So depends on the project, but yeah, anyway, good answer, Pat.
Okay, so I know we're gonna need to move on, but there were a couple of questions, Pat, that came in about the pro forma examples that you showed, particularly about tax credits. So I'm going to kind of roll these questions up into one, and you can, try to address as much as you can. So there was a question about how you would account for time in this pro forma model. Are you looking at discounted cash flows at this level of analysis, or are you not dealing with that? And that's because tax credits or incentives might not, be realized for several years. There was another question about tax credits and what percentage would go to a syndicator. And then the last question was about tax credits versus tax abatements. And are we looking at both? Are they on the same performer? Are they on different, you know, in different places in the performer? So those just, those are the questions that came up.
All good questions. And I might look to my colleague, Jim, to help me answer some of these. This came from a pro forma, you know, I'm familiar with the model, but I think this particular situation, Jim, is this hypothetical is he has more kind of experience on that. So I can let him weigh in on some of this as well. So in terms of the timing, I mean, I think that that's a really good point. I'll let Jim answer how that was dealt with here, but I, you know, how I would deal with that is, yeah, I would look at the, I would, you know, look at the time value of money there, and I would apply a discount factor for those, you know, if it's a, you know, a future tax credit, then it should be discounted to, so that those are present value dollars. Present value analysis.
Yeah, and you know, we do take into account time value on a lot of these, but our first cut is really looking at it in a present dollar basis, assuming all of the credits occur all at once. But tax credits, and it's a good point, you know, generally occur over time. Sometimes they may not occur until the project is complete, or they may ramp up depending on the project. And so in those cases, we would do a net present value calculation for that. But what Patrick just went through is really the first cut to say, should I even be spending more time, looking at this project? Is there something there? A lot of times, you know, with just this first cut, you may be willing to go out and start talking to developers and say, you know, look, are you interested in this product? Project, what do you need to know, in order for you to feel more comfortable with it, those kind of things. So a lot of times it doesn't make a lot of sense to do extensive analysis until you really understand what the developer's issues are.
Excellent. Thank you, Jim.
Good point. And yeah, again, keeping it high level, I think, is really appropriate for this kind of first cut, this level of analysis. And I mentioned this, I think, several times probably in my presentation, but the models really do range from very simple to very complicated, and they're going to be, different development groups really kind of, it's a very proprietary thing, these financial models, because you can spend a ton of resources in developing them, and they can be extraordinarily complicated. They might be particular to your business. Certainly they're going to be property type specific. So, there will be many, many more levels of analysis as you move forward. But, for the purposes of understanding the economics at a high level, we think, you know, what is included as a example in the guide and what we generally went through today at a very high level and very quickly, we think is a good start.
Yeah. And just so everyone understands the point of it with the guide, is to give communities a basis to start the communication with developers, right? Developers come in, they start asking a bunch of questions. You don't know what analysis they've done or no, but if you've done that analysis ahead of time and have some sense of what the economics might be, you can then engage them on a different level, right? Rather than just, oh, let me get you that answer. You're in the conversation with them, and then you can begin to draw them in, attract them, and ultimately it'll be a negotiation, you know? So this is the point of getting you into that conversation with the developer using his metrics and his way of thinking about a project.
Thanks. Okay, great questions. Thanks, everybody. We are going to move on to the next portion of the webinar.
Yep, back to me. I'm gonna move through this relatively quickly because we do want to get to the investment package as well. But just to sort of sum up where we are and moving forward. The real question now is putting together a strategy. How am I going to go about attracting a developer and pulling together my process for moving this site to a development? So let's go to the next slide. I want to base this process on this pyramid that we've used for quite some time, and it's been pretty successful with respect to that. It's really sort of building on a good foundation and moving up through the pyramid to help close on a transfer. Next slide. So the foundation of that pyramid, as you saw, was a well understood site. What do we know about the site? And the more you know, and the more you can identify the potential risks, the more you can identify what the roadblocks may be for development, the more successful you're going to be in moving through a transaction. And at some point, you're going to need to be sitting down with the developer and trying to negotiate a contract, a sales agreement of some sort to pass this property on to a developer. And when you look at the transfer of the site, you really want to make sure that you know the site well enough, you identify qualified purchasers. And this is really important, is really vetting the purchasers that you move forward with in these discussions. Do they have a good reputation and a reliable track record for development? Have they created value with transactions, or are they buying properties and just sitting on them? Do they have a strong team? And not only from the standpoint of the developer, but where are they getting their money from? Who's their environmental consultant? Who's their demolition contractor? The kind of things you want to know about how well organized that developer is to pull off the development. Obviously, in some cases, the community has opinions about certain developers, so you want to make sure that developer is acceptable not only to the community but to the local government as well. And you want to also see how well they've been in assuming short-term and long-term responsibilities and liabilities. Next slide. Once you've identified your contractor, you're now in some sort of negotiation to close on a transfer. The two big things that are going to drive any sales agreement is going to be the indemnities and the guarantees that go along with that. In any transaction, the seller and the buyer, the community and the developer, are going to want certain assurances. If the community is going to agree to do remedial action, to pay for asbestos removal, they want assurances that that's going to happen. And whether that happens before the actual land transfer or after, those are things that need to be negotiated. On the other side, the community wants to make sure that the developer is going to do what they said to do. If the developer is going to assume the responsibility for maintaining institutional controls, are they going to indemnify for that purpose? And in some cases where a developer is going to conduct remedial action after closing on the property, you may want to have some guarantee they have the money available to do that work and provide some financial guarantee as well. Next slide. And in any transaction, there is going to be the environmental issues and the cleanup. And one of the things that we should always look at is the environmental regulatory program that's going to oversee any remedial action, particularly remedial action that's going to occur post-closing. In many cases, brownfield sites will go through a state voluntary action program, and many of those programs have various types of assurances for purchasers for both liability protection, but also allowing them to become the party responsible for doing the cleanup and working directly with the agency. And under the federal programs, there's also various liability protections that are associated with those programs that should be considered, in addition to looking at land use based endpoints as well. Next slide. And sort of last but not least, and something that's been very common, particularly in commercial transactions, is the use of insurance, pollution legal liability insurance in particular. And this insurance will help cover things like undiscovered or unknown conditions on a site. We can do We can do a lot of assessment on a site, but in the end, there's always the risk that something may be unknown that may show up later. And can we insure for that? As well as dealing with any excess liabilities that may be associated with a site. You know, for instance, if a developer agrees to clean up for a particular issue, they may be able to gain excess insurance to cover things if it goes more than what they had anticipated. But this insurance is generally something that's purchased by the developer. In many cases, the cost is assumed by the developer, but also the seller can be provided as an added insured under these policies to provide some of those protections. But one of the keys to obtaining this type of insurance is really having a very good understanding of the site. And so having a good, well-conducted, final approved site assessment on the property is in general a very important part of getting insurance. Next slide. So just going back to our site, our hypothetical site, when we go back and look at the pro forma, we look at all of the issues we've just discussed. One of the things that can happen is the community can assume certain liabilities, or what I'm calling here address retained liabilities. So they can complete any environmental investigation that needs to be on that site and maybe conduct hotspot removal and obtain a no further action determination. And this assumes that there may be federal or state grant money that's available to support those activities. In the same fashion, is there available public funds to deal with asbestos removal and clean up on the buildings to minimize the cost of the developer for the redevelopment? And in this case, there's other buildings on there that may need to be demolished. And can those be things that the community may be willing to deal with? On the other side, we can transfer liabilities to the developer, and hopefully they have a very similar vision for the property. So the buyer would assume any of the remaining environmental obligations. And keep in mind, at minimum, in any property transfer, there is going to be a requirement for maintaining an institutional control unless the site's cleaned up to an unrestricted use. But in this particular case, there may be a soil and management plan associated with dealing with excavations and groundwater on the site. There may be a monitoring program that requires groundwater to be monitored for some period into the future. And can the developer pick up those costs? And then finally, be able to provide an indemnity back to the town for any future liability related to the environmental condition on the property. So that, I realize it's a very simplified approach, but in general, these are the kind of things you would see as part of the transactional strategy for a particular site. Next slide. So with a disposition strategy in hand, the real focus now would turn to taking steps to attracting developers to the property. So I'm going to turn it over to Will, and he's going to go through the investment package. Will?
Thanks, Jim. And as you know, now we have we've collected all this information, as Patrick and Jim have alluded to. And now what do we do with it? We need to put together this investment package in order to really tell a compelling story about your site redevelopment as well as your community. If you go to the next slide, please. First, I just wanted to highlight the soon to be released guide that EPA, the Office of Brownfield and Land Revitalization, is putting out. It's titled Creating a Brownfields Investment Package, a guide to help communities attract resources to revitalize blotted or contaminated properties. It's really an in-depth guide for the investment package process of how you can really, like I said, transform the information that you've gathered in the first two steps in regards to reuse assessment, in regards to reuse plan, and put them together in this package that really tells a compelling story about your community. And I know we mentioned before there was a lot of detail in regards to numbers, and sometimes communities kind of bypass that section, but it's really important in regards to an investment package, a brownfields investment package, to pay particular attention to the numbers and include them in the package in order to help communities really think like a developer, in order for developers to understand the risks involved and how they might mitigate those risks. If you go to the next slide, please. And so really, you know, what is an investment package? How can we explain what an investment package is described here? So really it's the overall market traction and potential for redevelopment in a way that attracts local, regional, and national resources. It's also a way to establish priorities or specific vision that your community has. And I want to point out, it's not meant to be really text heavy. It's really a document. It's more of a visual representation of your community specific to the redevelopment of brownfield sites. As I go through the slides, you want to pay specific attention to the images on the slides. Like Patrick and Jim alluded to, we have gone through a hypothetical situation or site, and we've also included that within these slides in regards to the investment package, just to help you get a visual image of what an investment package might look like. And I also failed to mention that in the attracting investment guide that EPA is putting out, there are a lot of really good examples throughout that guide of other communities that have investment packages and what they did. And there are links to go to those examples. There are also a lot of valuable resources that you can utilize to find some data or information in regards to gathering the information for the investment package. If you go to the next slide. Oh, one other thing I wanted to point out on that last slide, kind of the final point, it's not meant to be an isolated exercise. You want to include key stakeholders in your community throughout the entire process and really utilize their expertise to help kind of unify the community around a specific vision, and really to allow those stakeholders to support the project, support the community as you go throughout the process. Even after the package is complete, you still want to support that project and allow the community and allow the stakeholders to be ambassadors for this package. So next slide, please. So what does the package include? When you're thinking about putting it together, you really want to think about these four elements to include in the package. And the first one's economic context. And in regards to the economy, your site, it's not just dependent on your local economy. Your community is within a broader regional ecosystem. And you want to think about that when you're putting together your package. For example, you might want to include drive times. You might want to include specific sectors in your region, specific institutions in your region, specific companies in your region. All these things that define a region rather than just your local community. And then going on to governance context, you want to be sure you provide any needed local government information. Think of it as kind of an introduction to your community, to the specific people in your community and to the government systems. Those people may be the mayor, maybe the economic development director, maybe someone that is in charge of specific incentives within your community. Anything that would help define kind of the governance structure. You also may want to include some demographic information in this context, but really pay particular attention to the governance structure, and also include, this is really important, as I know Patrick and Jim talked about, the importance of subsidies, the importance of incentives when you're going through a project and how they can, make a project work. So you want to include those incentives in your investment package and how they can be utilized and who to contact for those. The next one is local information. You know, after you've presented the broader region, you want to focus on the local, and though, you know, just to help define the specific area, but also, you know, the surrounding context. And then you get to the project specific information. This is really important when we're talking about detailed information on the specific site. I know in the last two sections, a lot of that was talking about the specific brownfield sites. So you want to include information such as whether your community has control of the site, how the redevelopment aligns with city goals, any completed conceptual designs that you have for the site, and any financial analysis, as Patrick alluded to during his presentation. Next slide, please. And so keeping those four elements in mind as you go through the process, you want to set the stage for different types of investors or different types within the investment community. You want to structure your package around these seven content areas described here in order for the development community to kind of familiarize themselves with the site and with your community. And those are purpose, regional introduction and local governance, market assessment, area overview, area assets, specific property overview, and development potential. And I'm gonna go through each one of these in more detail. But like I said before, keep in mind that we are using the hypothetical situation that we described before. And if you look at the images on the side of each slide, that's just a visual representation of what we have put together for that hypothetical situation. So if you go to the next slide, please. This is just the beginning, kind of the beginning opening of the investment package. And it really points to the purpose, not the purpose of the project, but the purpose of the investment package and why you've put it together. You want to make this really short, really visual, articulate, and kind of visually describe your goals for the investment package. As you can see here, it's to describe your community's assets, to present a unified vision, and to really reach potential investors within the development community. You go to the next slide. So regional introduction and local government governance. So I kind of talked about this before. This is a really important slide when you're introducing your community and introducing the specific key members of your community with contact information. You also want to just give a brief overview in regards to demographic or socioeconomic data points and local trends. You can just highlight that here in this slide. As I said before, the guide that I referenced that EPA is putting out gives a lot of resources of where you can gather this data and this local information. But also important to this slide is really the available incentives or any subsidies that you may have or can utilize for a project. You know, we already talked about how a project sometimes, especially in smaller communities, mid-sized communities, how you need those subsidies in order to make it work. And it's important to highlight that here on this slide to help the development community understand the risks, but also how they can mitigate those risks and what they can utilize for that. You go to the next slide. Market assessment. I think we, you know, previously discussed that gathering the market information within the previous two steps. And this is just to point out that the project is not, it's not just based on a vision, but this is to help the development community understand that the market will support the vision, that there is important, you know, there is substantial information or there is substantial need in the market to help support the actual project that you're putting together. So if you go to the next slide. The area overview. This is just kind of a quantitative illustration of the key assets or strengths within your community. You want to point out the specific positive trends within your community, whether that be, as some examples here, economic indicators, employment industry profiles, employer statistics. Again, there are a lot of references, there are a lot of resources in the guide that will take you to places that will help you identify these indicators and these positive trends. And like I said, this is a lot of quantitative information, but you also want to include any accolades, any awards, any recognition that your community may have received over the last several years, just to highlight the strengths, the assets of your community. You want to really show these strengths and show the developers of you know, what the potential is for your community. If you go to the next slide. Area assets. So what sets your community apart? That's really what this slide is detailing. What makes it better than any other community? What would make an investor want to invest in community? That's what you want to include here. As you can see, as the specific examples in the slide under key advantages, we have location, industry specialization, industry safety and ease of concerns, and environmental, it's an environmental justice area. So all these are really key assets to the specific project, but also to the community. And it just helps the development community better understand what the potential is, better understand what the project is, and better understand what the advantages of investing in this project are. So if you go to the next slide. After you've identified the regional overview, the local information, the local overview, the assets of the community, this is a really important slide. This is a really important part of the investment package, which kind of sets this investment package apart from just your typical brochure. But this part really gets into the detail of the numbers, which I identified before, and shows how you can mitigate risks, shows the value in the project. It's important to show this overview of your site. And so in order to provide a general overview, you may want to include site orientation, which is really the size or the relation to larger communities within your region or within your state. You can also provide key socioeconomic data here. You want to include an area map, which to show kind of the land area, the developable acreage, as Jim was referring to, that you've already gathered, the zoning information, the site ownership. Also include local nearby assets. The site access map is really important. You want to include map access points to see the site through the lens of transportation modes and logistics. And you also want to include the environmental conditions that we've already discussed. You want to include this information, whether it be, you know, phase one, phase two information, whether a phase one and phase two has been conducted on the site, or any other known environmental conditions on the site, again, to help the development community understand the risks and how to mitigate those risks. You go to the next slide. And this is really the last point, the development potential. And these are the numbers that kind of Patrick presented during his presentation. And this is kind of the last point and really important part of the process. Here you want to be really clear and concise. Your goal is to give the investor specific ideas on how the site can and should be reused. So if you have a specific conceptual use plan, whether it be one scenario, whether it be multiple scenarios, you want to include it here. This slide also gives you an opportunity to speak the language of the developer. As a community, you want the developer to understand that the site will work based on numbers. It's important here to show the concept plans, like I said, but also the math and the numbers behind the project in a way that's easy to read, easy to understand, but shows the potential of the project and the financial feasibility for the development community. You go to the next slide. And finally, after you've put together all this information in the package, you want to promote the redevelopment potential. You want to utilize the package, present it in a way to really, again, solidify the unified vision that you have already put together, that your community is already working towards. So one way to do that, as I mentioned before, is to utilize your stakeholders. That's a really important point here, especially in the end. You want to utilize them throughout the entire process of putting the package together, but you also want to utilize them after it's together to help them to become ambassadors, to share the package throughout the community, throughout the investment community, whether it be on a local, regional, state, or even national level. Help to familiarize them with the package and to coach them to help them how to use it. Develop and share an elevator pitch if you have one. You know, how do you speak to the investment package? What are the important details? How can you speak to the investment community in that regard? Help the stakeholders better understand this so they can utilize the package and present it in a way, again, like a unified way that's important for the community. And then keep everyone up to date and celebrate any milestones as you're going through this process. You want to help people know what's been going on in your community, even after the package comes out. Celebrate the milestones. And then really, finally, I just want to point out, develop and implement an outreach plan to investors, whether that be through, you know, there are multiple number of ways that you could do this, whether it be, as mentioned here, through direct mail. You can make cold calls to developers or the investment community, send emails. You can invite potential representatives from the investment community to a roundtable, have them in, invite them to your site, or present the investment package at public and private events. And that's really the investment package as a whole, and what it is, how to utilize it, how to put it together, and how to make it form around your goals and development process. Next slide. And now, I guess if you have any questions, we can take them in regards to the investment package or just the overall presentation.
Yeah, thank you, Will. I do have a few questions about the investment package overall. So let's check in. So there's a lot of content in the investment package. How important is it to include all of the things that you went through?
That's a really good question. I think I did, even though I probably went through the slides fairly quickly, there is really a lot of content. And as I said, it's not really supposed to be text heavy. It's supposed to be more of a visual representation, but not every community is the same. You know, you want to remember those four core elements that I was talking about before and try to include them as you go through putting together your own investment package, but they're not all going to look the same. There's a lot of content that you can leave out, but you want to include the kind of your key assets. You want to promote your city in a way that benefits you, that benefits the site, that benefits the process, that helps the development community kind of better understand, like I said, the risks involved, but also the potential for the site.
Excellent, thank you. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how and when you can include community stakeholders as the investment package is being developed?
Yeah, sure. I think I alluded to it throughout the presentation. That's a really important point. Like I said, this is not meant to be an isolated process where the economic development director and mayor get together and put together this package to present to the investment community. You want to include your stakeholders throughout the entire process so that they are informed. Not only are they informed about the investment package, but also you want to utilize their expertise. You know, it's important to bring a diverse array of expertise around the table when putting together this package. You know, one person can't know everything. So it's important to include the key stakeholders throughout that process. But again, like I said, it's also important to include them at the end to become ambassadors, to help promote the investment package, to help promote the site for redevelopment, and to help promote it to the investment community so that not only you are working towards attracting investment, but the entire community is working towards attracting investment to the site.
Have you seen examples where they, you know, the investment package is a community, you know, engagement tool almost as much as it's an investment tool?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've seen in some communities, even as they get through the GOD, sometimes the redevelopment site is postponed. But then they have this GOD that is really a community, has been a community engagement tool that they can utilize. You know, going through the process is as much important as actually completing the GOD. You know, having the paper in front of you is good, but going through that process just helps the community better understand, gets a better vision from the community to have really a unified voice of what you want to do with this site, how you want to redevelop it, how you can mitigate the risks, and how you can introduce it to the investment community.
Thanks. A couple more questions. What is your opinion on how key it is to have pro forma numbers in the investment package? And then knowing that, you know, if you're a government agency, it can be hard to get those numbers, have real numbers.
Yeah, that's really important. I'm assuming you're talking about, or the question was referencing raw numbers in regards to the financial analysis. Is that?
That's yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. I think I alluded to it in my presentation. It's important because, you know, the community, I think we referenced this several times, but the community doesn't always think like a developer and vice versa. Developer doesn't always think as like a public entity. So including that financial analysis, including those numbers, really shows the investors how the site, you know, from a financial perspective, how you can make the site work, what are the risks, how you can mitigate the risks. And even as Mike Taylor was referring to, when you can mitigate the risks, when you can better understand the site from a financial perspective, it will benefit your site in multiple ways, whether it be cap rate or other various areas. So it's really important to include the details. You know, you don't have to include all the numbers, but just help the development community understand the risks, the financial risks involved, and how to mitigate those risks, what the subsidies might be, what the gap is. It's kind of a gap analysis and help and kind of to detail that within your information.
One more question here. What is your opinion on whether it's important to include a timeline within the investment package? If, you know, certain developers are interested in specific properties or in areas within the community. So can you talk to the time component of an investment package and where you would see that fitting in?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question and a really good point. I didn't reference that in the presentation, but if, you know, there are time constraints on the project, then the developer obviously needs to know. And you can, you know, like I said, investment package is going to look the same. So if it's important, if there are time constraints on your development, then yes, it's important to include a timeline for your project. You know, you can include it in the financial analysis. You can include it in other areas. You know, like I said, they don't all look the same. But yes, it's a really good point, and it's important to include that there depending on the project.
Thanks, Will. Oh, go ahead.
Hey, Mike. Amy, could I join in? So I think that question, I'm not sure, but it sounds like, you know, we are differentiating between an investment package or an attraction package and an RFP, right? So if you're trying to attract developers broadly, and you're trying to promote your community broadly, that would be what Will is talking about. And it gets updated, and yeah, things change. You want to make sure you're communicating that. If you're putting out an RFP, then you want to have a timeline in there, right? You want to have a date when those responses are due back. And you can use some of the information from this package, but they're really different tools for attracting the market. The other thing I did want to say is that all of this should be online. You know, Will talked about sending it out and emailing it and all that, but a lot of site selectors, you know, we talked about them in the first webinar, they're looking online, and developers will do the same thing. They'll Google your community. Oh, you know, so-and-so is complaining about the school lunches or whatever. You want to have a great website. You want to have all this information on it. And you want to be able to, that to pop right up in their Google search as to why they want to invest in your community.
Great points. Thanks, Mike. I am going to check our chat, our Q&A pod. Looks like we went through all our questions. So I don't know, does your presenters have anything that they want to add before we get to wrap up? Okay. All right, Abe, can you go to the next slide? All right, so I first want to thank our presenters. So thank you, Mike, Will, Jim, and Patrick. Excellent. I know that this material is complicated and talking about risks and financial feasibility and everything. It's hard to distill that, but I really do think that you've done a great job. And for those of you who are wondering, we are very close to having our investment package document ready and out the door. So give us a couple more weeks to kind of finalize everything, and then we'll be able to share it. And I want to let you all know, well, thank everyone for staying with us. We had a great crowd today, and so many of you are spent your Friday afternoon with us. So thank you. We are going to see you all again, hopefully in November, on November 19th, Friday, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern, where we'll talk about these success stories. And Mike mentioned earlier that he's got three success stories teed up to walk you through how this happens in real life. Is there anything more you want to say about that, Mike?
Yeah, I just want to say you're going to get to talk to the actual developers of the projects. They're going to open up their books. So all of these questions that you asked today, you're going to get perspectives from three different developers, one a private developer, one a community developer, and three, a foundation who is involved in bringing community benefits back to a community. So we're going to do the spectrum. We may end up with a fourth example, but we'll have a great time getting folks to share their, how they made the numbers work and the benefits of the projects that they brought to fruition. So we're very excited about that.
Thanks, Mike. We were going to have a workshop, in-person workshop with the Brownfields Conference, but the conference has now been postponed until 2022. So once we have either that rescheduled or a virtual option, we'll make sure that everybody knows about it and you can join us for that. Really fast, there was one last question that came in. Mike, I don't know if you've got a minute to address it, but somebody was asking about what you were just saying. You know, how will site selectors and developers find a small community? You know, what type of SEO are communities supposed to use to make sure developers find them? What are some ways that the communities can market themselves to get their names out there a little bit?
Yeah, definitely a good issue. There are lists, there are site selector organizations, there are site selectors who focus on types of development, and it's a matter of networking with them and finding which ones are looking for various things. And then just as Will said, you know, that idea of getting a group of committed stakeholders that go out to conferences, that hand out cards with the website on it, that speak about your community, I can't say enough about how the community can promote itself by getting engaged at various levels. And some of that is through professional organizations going to conferences that your community might not go to. It costs money, but you know, your states can help you. There are regional organizations that can help you, and they have funding to do this sort of work as well. So it's a matter of networking and finding who your partners are going to be, and then just continuing to work it, continuing to update it, and knowing what you want and focusing in on that. Beyond that, it's a site and community specific strategy. You know, we're happy to talk offline. Certainly you can email back through this. You know, we're going to be around, you know, through the next webinar and hopefully doing a workshop some way. So, you know, feel free to reach out and we can talk more.
Super. Thanks, Mike. Okay, that was our question, our last question. Thanks to everybody for being here. And great crowd, great questions. Gene, let me turn it back to you to wrap us up.
All right, Amy, thank you so much. I think what we're going to go ahead and do is close out today's live broadcast. Just a few quick gentle reminders for everybody who was able to join us in our session today. So the first thing that I wanted to remind everyone is that when you registered for our session, you got a confirmation or reminder email that had a link to the seminar homepage. We talked a bit about that at the very start of today's broadcast. So I'll just remind everyone that you can visit that seminar homepage to download copies of the presentation materials and take a look at other resources collected on our topic today. On that seminar homepage, there's also a very important tab or link to the seminar feedback form. I'll ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill that form out and let us know what you thought of our live delivery. For those of you looking for a certificate of participation, as soon as you fill out that feedback form, as long as you check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the whole live event, you can then immediately have access to a seminar participation certificate once you send in your feedback. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version, you can still submit your seminar feedback form and get a certificate based off of your replay of the entire archive. We'll be sending a follow-up email here in just a few days as soon as the archive is available for on-demand playback. So with that, I want to echo the thanks to each and every one of you, along with our speakers and organizers and the support team who are on in the background to help make sure that today's session took place. And with that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so